session number 18776, Reel 1.
Colonel Stuckey, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
Well, I was born in the county of Somerset in a village called Yatton, south of Bristol, 12 miles south of Bristol, in the year 1920.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Somerset?
Yes, I did. I, in fact, at the age of 7, having been to the local school in the village, kindergarten, then I moved on to prep school, which was the preparatory school of the Bristol Grammar School. And when I was just short of 8, I used to walk nearly a mile to Yatton Station. Then I boarded the train for Bristol, 12 miles to the north, and I would then walk to the school, which was another probably 2.5 miles. So from a very early age, I was accustomed to, should we say, being on the line of march. And so in later years, when I became an infantryman, it was not too difficult, perhaps. But in those days, travel was safe, efficient, simple, easy, and my parents, I think, had no great misgivings about allowing me, under the age of 8, alone, to do this journey, as it were, single-handed. Although, of course, on the train, and one tended to meet up with the odd chum who also was going to the same place. We were given a penny, which was a tram fare from Bristol Temple Reed Station to the tramway centre, and thereafter we were meant to walk. However, we soon discovered that, in fact, if you legged it out pretty quickly, you could get to the tramway centre almost as quickly on foot as indeed did the tram, thereby acquiring a penny, pocket money. And if you did the same in reverse going home, you were making tuppence a day. And in those days, and I'm talking about 1927-28, tuppence bought quite a lot of sweets. So it was quite a good bet. So that is how I started. I went to Bristol Grammar School, the preparatory department. I was intended to go on to Blundell School, Tiverton, but I didn't, I think because I think my parents took the view that I was doing quite well at the grammar school, or they thought I was doing quite well, and it had a very high reputation academically, of course, as it still does. So in fact I moved into the main school when I was only 12, and thereafter I went on and moved through the school and took my school certificate, as it used to be in those days, went into the sixth form and took my higher school certificate, as it was, it's now the, I suppose, A level. And then I got into the Officers Training Corps, where I was finished up by being the Company Sergeant Major, the head of the OTC, so to speak, and I also became a school prefect. And but at that stage, I think I was more interested in rugger and cricket and the OTC than I was in academic pursuits. However, I'd already made up my mind in the sixth form that I was going into the army because the war clouds were on the horizon, and in the words of General Sean Hackett, who was one of my idols, I suppose, General Sean Hackett joined the army ex Oxford University. He could have been a Don, but he said, I decided not to be a Don at Oxford. I decided that it might be better to go into the cavalry, join the army as a career, because I could see the war clouds looming on the horizon, and I thought that if I was going to be killed, I might as well be killed as a professional rather than an amateur. So I said, I think I must have had the same in the back of my mind at that age. So in fact, I eventually left the school. We didn't have an army class, we weren't an army school as such, and so I had to go then to London, where I spent a couple of terms with a well-known crammer, famous crammer, David Slam and Dick, and they were getting people ready to take the civil service exam for entry into the Navy, Army, Air Force, Royal Marines. And so at the end of two terms there, I took the exam, and that was, I suppose, at the end of 1938. And I got through and was accepted into Sandhurst in July of 1939. The course at the Royal Military College, as it then was a full 18 months, but because of the war clouds looming, they decided to cut it down to a year. So we went expecting to do a year only. In fact, did far less than that, because the war started very soon after, in fact in September, and because of that they decided that our batch of cadets, or we were known as gentlemen cadets in those days, and our batch were destined to be commissioned at the end of 1939. So I was duly commissioned. And I was just after my 19th birthday, and I went into the Staffordshire Regiment, or the South Staffordshire Regiment, as it then was, and from then on my career took various turns. But interestingly,
when did you get the commission?
In the December of 1939, when I was just after my 19th birthday, and.
Had you had a particular interest in the South Staffordshire?
No, I didn't, in fact. The reason I went into the South Staffords was rather oblique. It was to do with the fact that my county regiment would have been the Somerset Light Infantry, but in those days things were rather different. And some counties, some county regiments, a few of them, tended to be rather expensive. And one thing I discovered was that my friend, a chap called Stevens, who went into the Somerset Light Infantry, wanted me to go into it with him. But I discovered that you needed a private income. Your pay was only 11 shillings a day, let's face it, 55p a day. And although that went quite a long way, you did need a certain amount of assistance from your family or parents to see you through the first 3, 4, 5 years of your commissioned service, perhaps. And the Somerset Light Infantry tended to be a bit expensive. And so because of that, I didn't like the idea of bearing on my father anymore. So I went into the South Staffords on the recommendation of my platoon commander, who was, in fact, Bernard Ferguson, a famous name from Shindit legends. And he happened to know the regiment quite well, because he had been the ADC to General Wavell when General Wavell was commanding the Aldershot Brigade pre-war. And General Wavell always said that the South Staffords were the best battalion in his brigade. Anyway, so Bernard Ferguson said, why don't you try the South Staffords? So indeed I did just that, not knowing anything about the South Staffords. But I was with them thereafter. So, in fact, I've had a series of regiments. What I didn't mention was that at the beginning of the war, we were all conscripted into the Queen's Regiment, for the simple reason that pre-war, at the Royal Military College, the so-called gentlemen cadets were not subject to military law. And this worked very well in peacetime, and the general arrangement was that you went there at the expense of your parents, of course, who had to buy your uniform, pay for your keep and everything. And but at the same time, because you were not subject to military law, if you decided that life in the army was not for you, you could always pull out, and that would be the end of story. Equally, if they didn't like you or the way you were behaving, they could say, well, goodbye. We don't think you're in the right hole, you know, a square peg. So that all worked very well. But when the war came, it was obviously unacceptable to have a bunch of future officers under training, but not subject to military law. So we all had to form up 2 days after the war started and be conscripted as private soldiers into the Queen's Regiment. So that was my first cap badge, you could say, in theory, although we never actually wore it. We wore the cap badge of the Royal Military College Sandhurst, which is now the Royal Military Academy Sandhurst, of course.
Have you any memories of Bernard Ferguson personally?
Yes, certainly I have, because he was a striking figure at that time. He was a black watch, and he was a kilted figure, and he was, I can only describe him as the last word in being immaculate, with his Glengarry, his tartan, and his white spats, and his black brogue shoes. He was a very military figure, very impressive, and we got to know him a bit, and we discovered that he was a man of parts even in those days, because he was quite good on the piano, recitations. He was into literature, and he was. We began to feel that perhaps he was a man of letters as well as a man of action. But then, of course, our paths changed, and I went into my regiment, he went his way, and we met up again somewhat obliquely, when we both became Chindits. And he was, as you know, author of two or three books on the Chindits, Beyond the Chindwin, for example, became quite a literary figure. And he published various books of poems and so on, and went on to become Governor General of New Zealand, and inherited a knighthood, and then, of course, at the end of his day, he became a member of the House of Lords. But I saw him, certainly, out in the war, and then at a much later stage, I met up when he was at the Imperial Defence College. And he came out to Malaya on a sort of break tour. The Imperial Defence College, in fact, was going to Washington, going to America, and he decided that he didn't want to go to America, he'd much rather come out to the Far East. And at that time, he wanted to renew his acquaintance, I think, with the Far East. And at that time, I'd become Brigade Major of a Gurkha Brigade, and we were told that Brigadier, as he then was, Ferguson, was going to descend upon us for a few days to be hosted by us. And so I met up with him socially and also professionally, I might say, at that time. And that was 1953, as I recall. But he was still in great heart, in great form, and a splendid soldier. Of course, he left the army, as you may recall, for a limited period after the war. And I think it must have been 46, 47, to become head of the Palestine police. And he had a problem with the Irgun's Fale Umi and the other terrorist organizations they were trying to deal with at the time. And it all ended up, I think, with the Roy Farron case. And you may remember that Roy Farron was out there. He was an army officer seconded, if I recall, to the police. And he got involved in, I think, what might be termed I suppose, to put it bluntly, an assassination. But perhaps I'm not choosing my words very carefully. But what happened was a certain terrorist was knocked off. And the assumption was that this was by direction of the head of the police force, i.e. Brigadier Ferguson, and in the event, Roy Farron was brought to trial in Palestine on a charge of, I suppose, murder. Anyhow, I'm sure what he did was totally justified, but nevertheless it wasn't within the law, which had to take its course. And the only evidence, real evidence against him, was Brigadier Ferguson. And Brigadier Ferguson, when the trial came, declined to give evidence on the grounds that he might be incriminating himself, and he was quite entitled so to do. And that caused a bit of a furore in the press, a few headlines and so on. Head of police declines to give evidence, and things like that. And as a consequence, Bernard Ferguson was sent back to England, sent home. After that, he went on, he commanded the Black Watch, as a lieutenant colonel, of course, and did various things. I think he was quite successful. But he wasn't really, I suspect, totally happy as a peacetime soldier. He'd seen it all. I think he was a little bit champing at the bit. And, of course, he left the army as a brigadier, having commanded a brigade, I think, in BOR, and went on to do other things. It wasn't too long after that that he got out to New Zealand as Governor General. And I know that he was very successful out there, of course. I was some years afterwards, I was, in fact, at a rifle meeting, and I was attached to working with the Territorial Army at that stage, and that would be in 1965. And I was at a Territorial Army rifle meeting, and I found myself standing on the firing point with Lord Hawke, who was the Worcester. He was one of the sort of patrons, as it were, of the Territorial Army, chairman, I think, of the Territorial Army Association. And so we got talking, and then the name of Ferguson came up. He had been Governor General, actually, of New Zealand. And so we got talking about it, and he said, well, he said, I'll tell you a story about Ferguson. He said, when I was actually out there as governor, I got a slightly concerned signal from Whitehall saying Ferguson name recommended to succeed you as governor. What do you think? And of course, because Ferguson's was to some extent a slightly controversial character, partly because of his performance with the Palestinian police, and getting himself in the headlines. There was a certain amount of head scratching as to the fitness of this appointment. Anyway, he said, I thought about this, and he said, so I sent back a signal saying, I take a chance on him, accept him, recommend him. And he said, of course, in fact, he came out, took over from me, and he was an outstandingly successful Governor General of New Zealand, and so my judgment was justified. So I thought that was an amusing little aside. And then I didn't meet him again, in fact, I think the last time I think I saw him, perhaps, was in Malaya. That's right, when he came out there. And then, of course, he died, having gone into the House of Lords, hereditary title. And I went to his... Oh, of course, I forgot to say, if we're talking about Bernard Ferguson, after being Governor General of New Zealand, he became head of the British Council. And so I think he did that with some distinction. And again, he was a man, he was an Elizabethan figure, was Ferguson. He was a man of action, but also a man of letters. And he was a great figure. But anyway, I went to, next time I came across him, though I didn't come across him, I went to his memorial service. Was it St. Boniface's in London, just behind Harrods, the Church of Scotland main church. And I thought there'd be a strong element of military there, but in fact... there was a detachment from the Black Watch in uniform, representing the Black Watch. But most of the people in St. Boniface's were, of course, British Council, New Zealand House, House of Lords, literary people, a whole cross-section of interests where he had influence and where his name was much respected. So he was, in many ways, a great figure. So that's my recollection of Bernard Ferguson. But I was considered myself very lucky to have been under his influence for only a short time, a matter of about 3 or 4 months, at Sandhurst. And so I look back on those days with some warmth.
Now, let's pick up the December 1939 when you were commissioned into the South Staffs.
Yes.
What happened then?
Well, I found myself posted to the depot. And I went there early in January in 1940, and my job was to get on with training of recruits. which was my lot, and it was really back to basics, back to the drawing board with these chaps coming in off the streets and so on. But it was pretty straightforward stuff, except the numbers, of course, were enormously increased from anything the depot had known before. My first sort of impact of the war proper was when suddenly in May, I think it was, we were summoned and we were told by our then commanding officer that we'd been given a job, and our job was to look after all those people, or some of those people, who had been evacuated from Dunkirk, when we pulled out of France. And we didn't quite know what was coming, but we were told that there were going to be an awful lot of people descending on our doorstep who would need looking after and hosting for an indefinite period. And sure enough, they started to arrive trainload after trainload at Lichfield Station. We had to pick them up in lorries, bring them up to Whittington Barracks, Lichfield, about 3 miles out, and take charge. And they were all without weapons, as it were, disheveled, and in a pretty poor state, frankly. And so we looked after them. And I remember very well, the officers, of course, were allowed to go in the officers' mess, and I think we had a batch of officers who came in, and their first, I think, reaction was to have breakfast, a sort of late breakfast at about 10 o'clock, because they hadn't eaten for days, some of these people. And they had, a jolly good meal in the officers' mess, and I went in, remember going back into the officers' mess at about 12:45, I suppose it would be, for my own little lunch and snack, and I was amazed to see that the whole of the anteroom floor was covered with bodies. And these were officers who just collapsed. They'd had something to eat. They couldn't find anywhere to lie down except the floor. And about a dozen or 15 officers, absolutely out for the count, on the anteroom floor, sleeping it off. And so this went on for something like a couple of weeks, and we had to ticket and docket this lot, find out where they come from, and then restore them to their units, equip them, reclothe them, feed them, and generally look after them. And so that was quite a big job of an administrative nature, you might say.
This is Lichfield.
Lichfield, Whittington Barracks, Lichfield. Yes, that was the home of the regiment.
And were you in a battalion of the South Staffs?
Well, this was the depot of the South Staffers. And to follow on, the next thing that happened to me was that I got a posting order and I was told I was going to join the 10th Battalion. Well, no one had ever heard of the 10th Battalion, but the 10th Battalion turned out to be one of these curious wartime creations, which were formed by gathering people from all parts of the country, and so I went round to join them, and I think I was told to report to the headquarters at Red Hill at the time, or Dorking. Anyhow, I found myself in a company on the airfield at Red Hill, and our job was to defend the airfield, because the great threat in those days was German parachuters coming over. So we set up a ring of defences around the airfield, with a view to warding off attack, and waited to see what would happen. The people using that particular aerodrome were the RAF Lysanders, which is the Army Corporation aircraft, and it was an operational airfield. And there we stayed for a time. The only thing I remember there was that the RAF, we used the RAF mess, they hosted us, looked after us as best they could. And the other thing I remember is that I got to know my platoon, and I think my platoon had representatives from every nook and cranny of Great Britain except Staffordshire. I don't think there was a single Staffordshire soldier in my platoon, but every other dialect, every other part of the country was represented. So I got to know a wonderful cross-section of people from different backgrounds, from all over the country, Scotland, Welsh, the lot. So that was interesting, a mixed bunch, you might call them. Anyhow, in the fullness of time, we were suddenly told that we were required to move up north, and in fact to Scotland, which is quite exciting, because some of us hadn't been to Scotland before. Travel, you've got to remember, in those days was very restricted. I mean, at that age, I was then, 19, I had never even left the country, let alone anything else, unlike today when everyone has been everywhere. However, we went to Scotland, and we went to, Falkirk. We were there for a week or two, and they decided that wasn't the right place. We were then moved to a place called Dunfermline, and my company was in the park. And so we spent something like 2 or 3 weeks or a month there, I suppose. And then they decided that that wasn't quite the right place anyway. So we were told to go down to Barry Budden to virtually do coastal defence. So we set about that. And we hadn't been there really, I think, more than about a week or two when... on one Saturday night, I was in the officer's mess with the commanding officer, the adjutant, and the quartermaster, and there were just the four of us in the mess who decided for some reason that we didn't want to go out. Well, I think Theo wouldn't go out anyway. The adjutant probably felt he wasn't his job to go out. But the whole of the battalion, I think, had gone into Perth. It was Perth, anyhow, nearby town. And... it was their night out, in short, and so they'd been lorried in, and they were on the town. And then, at about 10 o'clock, the adjutant, Fred Brady, a regular officer, Stafford, came in to the mess and handed a piece of paper to the commanding officer, looking rather white. And the commanding officer said, "Good God, it's invasion. Where are the soldiers?" Fred Brady said, "Well, I'm afraid they're all in the in the town." So the commanding officer said, "Well, get them back. Get them back as quick as you can." Anyhow, that was a pious hope because, of course, they were all over the place. Anyway, to cut a long story short, the troops arrived back by midnight, which they're sort of reporting in time. And this would be in September of 1940. And I remember them coming into the guard room, getting off their buses, and they were all sort of half seas over. I think they all had a fair amount to drink. And I remember getting hold of my little lot and trying to explain to them that our job was to get down to the beaches pretty damn quick and to prepare the defences, threaten invasion. Well, the somewhat sceptical Tommy of the day thought this was just another officer gag for a bit of training, just to show them, you know, this is not the way to behave. They wouldn't believe it. So my job then was to try and convince my 18 or 20 rag and tag bobtail soldiers that this wasn't a joke, it wasn't an exercise, it was for real. And I remember having got them eventually together, about 22 of them, I suppose it would be, walking across for about a mile across the sand dunes. Now, these chaps behind me, all effing and blinding, and the air was quite blue. However, we eventually got to the sort of our little sector. My company commander said, "Well, you know, this is your little area of deck for your platoon. Get your chaps digging." And so we set about that, and we did the best we could. And then we dug through the night. And then come about daylight the next morning, which is about 7 o'clock, would it be, something like that, I remember the second in command came round and took one look at our defences and said, "Oh, that's no bloody good. You're all in the wrong place. You'll have to move." So that didn't exactly please the troops either, because they'd been digging all night, they had no breakfast, and they were told that all their efforts were for naught.